Well, I decided tonight, since we have a Q&A, I kind of decided to do this a little bit different. I wanted to start with an answer, or with a question. I want you to think of something that you know, something that you know, a spiritual fact, something that you know that you could explain to anybody that asks. And then my question is, when did you learn it? Can you pinpoint when you learned that specific fact? And I know I can't. And I don't know if it's something that I've heard. Maybe it's something I learned studying on my own. Or maybe it's something I learned from my family when I was younger. Or maybe it's something that I heard in a sermon. I know there's several times I have, as I'm speaking, and I'll remember something and I'll try to give credit for it and I can't. And I'll say, well, I know there was a sermon. I'm pretty sure it was Terry. But I'll be honest with you, I really don't know who said what. But it's just a compilation eventually of how you gain your understanding and your knowledge base. So I say that tonight. I don't ever want us to be discouraged, especially on Wednesday nights, as we begin to see our numbers dwindle sometimes and think, oh, well, there's only a handful of people here. My question is, does it matter when you learn something? Does it matter if it's a full audience with Carl Johnson or Glenn Ballard pounding in the truth? Or is it discounted because there's only a handful of us tonight on a Wednesday evening? And obviously the answer, it doesn't matter. When we learn is when we learn. And so I want to take advantage of that no matter how many folks are in the audience. I'm going to try to teach the best I can, whether there's 100 people here or 10 or 8 or 20 or whatever. And I hope that can always be our encouragement. I hate it to see when congregations start cutting out services, and next thing you know, it's just kind of struggling to stay alive. I hope we don't ever take that approach. That being said, maybe 20 years from now, when Jake is able to answer this question, he doesn't have to remember when he actually learned it. But the important thing is that he did learn it. So on our Q&A, Jake had a question. And in typical Jake fashion, it's way out there. Jake has a question, and his question is the Euphrates River important? And so you might think about that and not have any idea what the importance of the Euphrates River is. It is extremely important. And in fact, it's going to become much and more talked about in the next couple of years, and I'm going to tell you why tonight. And so, Jake, we're going to try to find out why the Euphrates River is still important today. Before we go further, let's go to God in a word of prayer. Is the Euphrates River important? Maybe something you never thought about before. But let me begin by saying the Euphrates River is literally mentioned throughout the entire Bible. It is mentioned in the book of Genesis, and it goes all the way through the book of Revelation. And so I don't know if you can say that about too many places in the Bible. Genesis 2 and 10 tells us from the beginning, now a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it parted and became four river heads. Verse 14 tells us the fourth river is the Euphrates. So the Euphrates was tied together with the Garden of Eden, and it was one of the rivers that came through. Let me say this, though, that I don't know if that's the Euphrates River today. I'm reminded of a verse in 2 Peter 3 and 6 says that whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. So the water before, the world before the flood and the world after the flood, you can't compare them. And so I can't guarantee you that the Euphrates that's mentioned in relation to the Garden of Eden has anything to do with the Euphrates River of today. But that river is mentioned and it becomes very important in the story of God's people. So here's a map of the Euphrates today. And so if you're a world history person, you're going to pick up on a lot of this because we've spent a lot of time over in this area. This is the Middle East. And so you come down here to the Persian Gulf. And there's Kuwait. So we went to war there. And here's Iraq. And it goes all the way through Syria, all the way up into Turkey, and almost makes it to the Black Sea. And just as a point of reference, right on top of the Black Sea is Ukraine. And so we've got two major conflicts going on in this general part of the world, just like it's always been. And so you have the Euphrates River. There's actually two rivers that come through this area. The Euphrates River is the western branch. The eastern branch, right, not parallel, but kind of runs into the side of it, is called the Tigris River. And this land in between these two rivers has a special name. And in Greek, the name is Mesopotamia.
So we hear about that in the Bible as well. Mesopotamia literally translates as the land between the rivers.
And that's what it's talking about. It's the land between the Euphrates and the Tigris River. So the Euphrates River, very, very important. We know something about it because we've had so many wars over there recently. I have two teachers that work with me out at Wall. They come talk to my classes when we get to this part. One, he was took a picture. He showed it to me at the gates of Babylon. And so if you've ever seen the great picture of the old, there's one gate left of the city of Babylon. It's got cats all over the picture, which I thought was kind of neat. They held the cats as being sacred. But Bagdad is in between. It's a little bit closer to the Tigris River. So it's in this region of Mesopotamia. The other lady that was in the army, she said she was walking down one day, and I guess she was walking beside a tank or some type of armored vehicle. She was way up here, close to a town called Ur, which we've heard of Ur. That's where Abraham was from. So she said she was walking along, and just the dust and everything was kicking up. She looked down, and she found a little piece of pottery. And so she still got that. And we made up a good story out of it that had to have been Abraham's water bottle. Had to be. Because she, I don't know how old that little thing is, but she found a little piece of pottery. So we're talking about an immensely old location in the world that's been talked about forever. I wanted to throw this one on here just to give some perspective here. We've been hearing about this in the world. There's kind of the Middle East, and there's Texas. It is teeny tiny. And we don't think about that when we hear about everything in the Old Testament world. If you were to take this Texas and kind of slide it over a little bit and put East Texas about on Babylon, and that would push everything over to about the panhandles on the Mediterranean Sea, nearly everything we read about in the Bible, especially the New Testament, until they started taking across the Mediterranean, nearly everything we read about was in the size of about Texas, which is hard to believe because it just seems like it's such a huge world. But really not that big in terms of square miles. Well, in Genesis, the 15th chapter, God talks to Abram. And God makes a covenant with Abram. And this is one of the neatest stories you find. There's an old tradition, you pick up on it in Genesis, you also read it again in Jeremiah. That when you had an agreement, a covenant, you would take an animal and you would cut it in half, and you'd split that animal in half, and you'd have to walk through the two pieces of the carcass. And in doing so, that was like your way of notarizing a covenant. And so in this situation, this is what happened. This kind of the light of God crosses through. So Abraham doesn't really even know what's going on. But here's the promise that was made to Abraham, Genesis 15 and 18. It says, on the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. So the river Euphrates is used as a geographical marking of where the promised land was to end. Now, the river of Egypt, a lot of people suppose that's the Nile River. Some people argue it's probably not the Nile. It's a river that's a little bit closer, that makes more of a natural boundary on the Sinai Peninsula. But even so, it does talk about, as a boundary, the river Euphrates. Not too much longer, Deuteronomy 1 and 7, as we're about to take over the promised land. He says, take your journey and go to the mountains of the Amorites, to all the neighboring places in the plain, and the mountains in the lowlands, in the south and on the seacoast, to the land of the Canaanites and to Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates. So that was to be the boundary of God's people, was the land of Euphrates. So that kind of gives you a different perspective. And so I kind of found this map. Some people think this should be the border of Israel. That they think the border of Israel should go all the way to the great river of Egypt. And it's going to go all the way to the Euphrates. All the way up. And some people think that is the God-given boundaries of the borders of the country of Israel. And they're still fighting for that. Now, I'm going to tell you, that's never going to happen. Unless you clean out a whole bunch of Palestinians, that's never going to happen. Iraq is not going to give up half of its country to Israel. But there are some people that do think that that is the border, what it should be, of Israel. Other people think, well, I put a couple marks in here. Really, this is what the great river of Egypt means? I don't know. And some people think, when he's talking about the Euphrates, he's just talking about this northwest arm of it that would kind of
fit in more with what Israel is. And then you know how big Israel really is? Here we go. That's Israel. So Israel is just a teeny tiny country found in this Middle East. And we hear so much about Israel, it's really kind of small. To put that in perspective, I was just playing around today. Israel, the country today, is 8,500 square miles. The war is in Gaza and in the West Bank. Gaza is 139 square miles. And then the West Bank is 2,183 square miles. And so I started playing around with this. If you take Tamarind County, and every county that touches Tamarind County, there's eight. Just, and that's kind of the area that Megan travels in for the most part. That is actually larger than the country of Israel. Well, that's kind of fascinating to me. That all that trouble and all the fighting going on, it's in a country that roughly the size that Megan travels at least once a week. Then I got to looking at Gaza, where all the fighting is. Gaza is bigger than San Angelo. It's about the same size as Lubbock, though. So the size of Lubbock is where Gaza is. The West Bank is smaller than Crockett County. Just to kind of give you an idea of the difference of size and how much people are fighting over a very, very small portion of land, and it's bordered by the River Euphrates. 1 Chronicles 18 and 23 talks about David. It said, David defeated Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, as far as Hamath, and he went to establish his power by the River Euphrates. And so that was a marking. It was a boundary dedicated to God's people. But I do feel I need to say this. Israel today, and the Old Testament we read about in the Old Testament, they are not the same thing. And I think so many people have gotten all worked up over things. And I'm sorry about the war that's going on over there. And I'm sorry there's so many people getting killed. I'm sorry there's Palestinians getting killed. I hate just the whole idea of war and whatnot. But you hear people say, we've got to pray for Israel. And they'll pull verses out of the Old Testament to say, we need to be on Israel's side and we need to pray for Israel. And the simple fact of the matter is, Israel that we read about in the Bible does not exist anymore. And that's just the way it is. There is no Israel by ways of an Old Testament definition. Israel, we hear in the news today, the nation of Israel are not the same. The promises to the ancient nation of Israel were fulfilled, but it was conditional. They had to be faithful, and they were not. They were given the promised land, but the Jews did not follow the covenant of God, and it was taken away from them. Another thing I want to make sure we understand, Israeli does not mean Jewish today. These two words are not synonymous. Most people think they are. Palestinian does not mean Muslim. They're not synonymous terms. There are Israelis that are not Jewish. There are Palestinians that are not Muslims. But that's kind of not the picture that we've been given. I was looking up, I think, we've even created a new term for Judaism. We call it Orthodox. And that means they follow the Torah. And so they only make up something like 10 to 15% of all Jews that actually claim to follow as much they can the Torah. That's kind of interesting to me. So keep in mind, the nation of Israel in the Old Testament had their chance. And they were, all the promises were fulfilled unto them. But something bad happened. And here it is what Jeremiah says. He said, Jeremiah 11 and 9, and the Lord said to me, a conspiracy has been found among the men of Judah and among the inhabitants of Jerusalem. They have turned back to the iniquities of their forefathers who refused to hear my words. And they have gone after other gods to serve them. And the house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant, which I made with their fathers. They had their chance, and they broke the covenant. And once they broke the covenant, God is not responsible for fulfilling the covenant anymore. They broke the covenant. And so this idea that Israel's going to return to a place of prominence, and now we start getting into this premillennial ideas. And there's not going to be a king come back and rule from Jerusalem, and Israel's not going to be replanted here upon this earth. And we can't go back to these Old Testament prophecies very simply because the nation of Israel, the Old Testament, broke the covenant of God. And that's all there is to it. So Israel today is no longer the Israel of the Old Testament. That being said, there's a national boundary. The nations of Judah and Israel faced oppositions from the east, and that's where most of their enemies started coming from. The idea of the Euphrates River remained a symbol of everything else. It's the rest of the world. Ezra says it like this. The Persian king, King Artaxerxes, wrote a letter. It's found in Ezra, the 4th chapter. And it says to King Artaxerxes, from your servants, the men of the region beyond the river. And that phrase, beyond the river, is in reference to the Euphrates River. And it means way, way over there. It's on the other side of the world, is how we would say it. It's way out of the sticks. The Euphrates River was the boundary that separated the other world from God's people. That's what the Euphrates was. So the Euphrates River served as a natural boundary between the promised land and this eastern world. Now I put this little picture up here just because it's a movie I liked. I thought that might help explain it to Jake. This was Kristen's, little cousin Kristen's favorite movie. It's called The Lion King. And I remember this scene. This is the daddy lion, and he's telling the son lion. He says, anything that the sun touches is our land. He says, but don't go beyond the shadowlands. That's the shadowlands. That's not ours. And it's kind of that idea. It's this boundary. Don't go past that boundary. And so that's the way the nation of Israel looked at the Euphrates River. That's our boundary. Don't go beyond the boundary of the Euphrates River. Well, who lived beyond the Euphrates River? Well, Euphrates River comes right down here, and it comes up. Oh, so that's Babylon. That's the Medes. That's the Persians. And eventually we're going to talk about the Parthians. So all these enemies that are about to come in and destroy the Jews, it starts with Assyria. Assyria was up in this region. Assyria was defeated by Babylon. Babylon was defeated by the Medes and the Persians. And before too long, here comes the Parthians. So these were the enemies of God's people. And they were all from beyond the river. They had to cross the border of this river Euphrates. Jeremiah talks about this. Jeremiah 46 and 1. Then the word of the Lord which came to Jeremiah the prophet against the nations, against Egypt, concerning the army of Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, which was by the river Euphrates in Carchemish, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, defeated in the 4th year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. Whew. A bunch of words there. If you are a history person, you'll recognize this name, Carchemish. That is one of the most important battles in the history of military warfare. If you're going to name the top 10 battles in the history of the world, most people would name Carchemish, Thermopylae, D-Day, Gettysburg. There's several red letter dates that people remember. The Battle of Carchemish was where Babylon defeated Assyria and Egypt, and that opened the door for Babylon to become the major world power that it was for several hundred years. And so the Bible mentions this. It comes back in 2 Kings and kind of tells it again. 2 Kings 23 says, in his days, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, went to the aid of the king of Assyria to the river Euphrates. And King Josiah went against him, and Pharaoh Necho killed him at Megiddo when he confronted him. So I'm giving a little bit of a history lesson because it's all going to come together here at the end. Here's kind of a picture of it. Let me explain what happened. I had to add a couple more spots on the side of my map. I like this map, but it didn't have Babylon and Nineveh. Here's what happened. Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, attacked Nineveh. Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian army, the Assyrian Empire. Babylon defeated Nineveh. What was left of the Assyrians headed west, and they holed up at a spot called Haran. And so that's what was left of the Assyrian Empire, and it was tottering on complete and total annihilation. Babylon tied together with the Medes, and they started chasing down the Assyrians. The Assyrians were friends with Egypt, and so they called for help from the Egyptians to come help them against the Babylonians. So here comes the Pharaoh. He leaves Egypt, and he starts bringing his troops up. And he crosses Josiah's kingdom, what is left of the kingdom of Judah. And Josiah, who was the last really good king, stepped out and said, no, you can't cross. I'm not going to let you bring your Egyptian troops through our country. And so a great battle occurred. And the battle occurred at the town of Megiddo. Just remember that. It occurred in Megiddo. And that's where King Josiah, the last good king, he was killed in battle. And so then the Egyptians, after this little delay at Megiddo, made their way up, and they got to Carchemish, but they were too late. And at the Battle of Carchemish, the Babylonians defeated the Assyrians, and the Egyptians were too late to help. So they got here, and they turned around, and they hightailed it back to Egypt with the Babylonians and King Nebuchadnezzar in hot pursuit. And that's when King Nebuchadnezzar overran Jerusalem on his way to Egypt. So there's a 10-minute history lesson, but all this stuff is going to become very important. So the idea of the Euphrates River had such an important meaning to the Jews because that was the boundary that God had given for their nation. All these bad guys were from beyond the river, whether you're talking about Assyrians, Babylonians, Medes, Persians, Parthians, those were the bad guys that went against God's people. Then we get to the book of Revelation. And we haven't heard much about the Euphrates River in a couple hundred years. None of the other writers have mentioned him once we get out of the prophecies until we get to Revelation chapter 9. And this is probably what Jake is talking about, these next two verses, because if you keep up with some of this end times prophecies, you've heard about this. Revelation 9 and 13 talks about the sixth angel. It says, "And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who were bound at the great river Euphrates." What in the world does that mean? Release the four angels that are at the river Euphrates. And a lot of people want to try to make this literal, which I don't believe we should do with the book of Revelation. In my mind, the book of Revelation, it is talking specifically about the Romans and their issues in the first century and with the wars and the battles that they were having. And that's what I think the book of Revelation is referring to. But this sixth angel is now tied with Revelation, the ninth chapter. Oh, let me continue, verse 15 rather. So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day, a month and year, were released to kill a third of mankind. Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them. And so there is a whole completely different mindset now when people have gotten into Revelation chapter 9. Go look it up if you're curious. And so this idea of the 200 million army has now got a lot of people all wound up, because people are now trying to put it in terms of 2023. Okay, well, if you took China and you took the Soviet Union or Russia, and if they came together and they picked up with maybe India or North Korea, that's the 200 million man army. And this is all prophesied in the book of Revelation. And they just go off on this end times thing that I don't agree with. I don't think this is written to us today. I think the book of Revelation was written to the people it was addressed to. It was written to the first century Christians and about Rome and the dealings that they were having with. Remember, the book of Revelation is written in symbols. It's not meant to be taken literally. Is it possible to have a 200 million man army in that location that I just drew up for you, just showed you on the map? Well, according to USA Today in July, here are the top 10 largest militaries right now. China has 2 million. We got a long way to go to get from 2 million to 200 million. That's a big jump. And really, the 200 million says they're just horsemen. That's not even the entire military. Those are not literal numbers that are used in the book of Revelation. Even if you added all of these up, we're not anywhere close to being 200 million. That is just a number that's way, way out there. We do that all the time. And I remember, again, here's where my mind goes. I think it was Paul in his lesson that I was talking about. Yeah, it was the host of heaven. And there were a lot of people for a long time had numbers on how many stars there were. 1,743 or whatever it might be. And then we discovered that we came up with a number that had 21 zeros at the end of it. That's how many stars there are. Eventually you just get to a point where numbers don't make any difference anymore. Is there 20 zeros or 21 zeros after? Our minds don't understand that. So in the Bible, sometimes they'll do it figuratively. And they may say something like this. They may say, Your descendants are going to be like the sand on the seashore. How do you put a number on that? Is that 100? Is that 1,000? Is it 1 million? Is it 200 million? Eventually, you get to be like a little kid. You know how little kids may be arguing about something, and you'll say, well, I'm going to have $1 million when I grow up. And the other kid, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to have $1 billion. And the other kid, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to make $1 trillion. And if you can get past trillion, the kids usually start making up words. Well, I'm going to have a gazillion, billion dollars. And they just make things up because eventually the numbers don't make sense anymore. That's all the 200 million is. It's not a literal number. It's just the enemies of God are going to be greatly, greatly multiplied. Now we go to Revelation 16. This is also tied with the river Euphrates. We have some angels come in and they have seven bowls. And they're pouring out these bowls in the Revelation. We get to the sixth bowl. It is dedicated to the Euphrates River. And this is the one right here that has most people in this end times prophecy world all freaked out. It says, then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. So he poured out this bowl and the river dried up. So the question is, is the Euphrates River drying up? And the answer is yes. The Euphrates River is drying up. There's no doubt about it. There has been prolonged drought in this area. There has been complete mismanagement by the countries that deal with the Euphrates River. If you remember the three countries I gave you, they're not exactly the who's who of humanitarian countries. Iran, Iraq, and Syria. They've all been in horrible wars, and civil wars, and distrust, and no interest in governments. And yes, the mighty Euphrates River is drying up. Here's a picture of it, and you can see from the satellites, it is definitely, definitely drying up. Scientists warn right now, they're expecting it to be completely dry if nothing happens in the year 2040. So you think that there's end times prophecies now? Wait till 2040 when the Euphrates River is completely dried up. And so people are freaking out about this. Oh, this is prophesied. Everything that we're reading about, and with China and North Korea and the war in Ukraine, and now we have Israel and Palestine, and there's all sorts of people getting all worked up about it, thinking that this is prophesied in the Bible. I don't believe that's what that prophecy means. Some people might be surprised to find out that the drying of the Euphrates River was used in prophecy a long time ago in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah also talked about it in verse 35. He's talking about, he's speaking out against Babylon and what's going to happen to Babylon. And Jeremiah says in verse 35, he says, a sword is against the Chaldeans, says the Lord, against the inhabitants of Babylon, and against her princes and her wise men. A sword is against the soothsayers, and they will be fools. A sword is against her mighty men, and they will be dismayed. A sword is against her horses, against her chariots, and against all the mixed people who are in her midst, and they will become like women. A sword is against her treasures, and they will be robbed. And then verse 38, a drought is against her waters, and they will be dried up. For the land is of carved images, and they are insane with their idols. And so there's the story of how Babylon fell. They dammed up the Euphrates River, and the Persians were able to go under the gates of the city of Babylon to destroy the city. And that's what brought down Babylon. So the idea of the waters of the Euphrates drying up meant that's where your enemies came from. Remember, Revelation is symbolic. So when we say no more Euphrates River, symbolically this means that the border that separated nations would be removed and nations would be overcome. That's what it means to talk about the Euphrates drying up. Is it talking about now? And I say no. In Babylon, circa 539 B.C., this is what Jeremiah was talking about. It meant that the Medes and the Persians from beyond the river, they're called the kings of the east, would be able to overrun the great empire. That's what it meant. What about during the time of Revelation? Well, for Rome, from about circa 54 B.C. to A.D. 217, this would include the time of Revelation, it meant that this horrible group from out east called the Parthians from beyond the river would be able to overrun the great empire. History will tell you that the great Roman Empire had three major flaws. One, it was hit by a series of natural disasters and calamity. Two, it was dealt blow after blow because of the inefficiency of its own government, and it was corrupt, and they turned against themselves, always in civil war. And the third thing was they kept getting attacked by a group of people that they could not defeat. And that was this group of people that came from beyond the river. And so when we start reading about beyond the river, that's what it's talking about. It's talking about anything that's to the east that crosses that border. I don't think it's talking about the literal Euphrates. I think it's talking about figurative Euphrates. It's the border that separates God's people from the bad guys. And he says it's going to come down. And the bad guys are going to have their way. And that's exactly what happened. And he says, don't be discouraged. But they're all going to come together. I've got one more verse for you. When all these bad guys cross the river Euphrates and this 200 million army, you know where they're going to have their battle at? Well, keep going in Revelation 16, verse 15. He says, behold, I'm coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And they gather them together to the place called Hebrew, Armageddon. And I left the footnote on. Armageddon literally means in the Greek, Mount Megiddo. Remember Megiddo? Megiddo was the city, and it was known in Jewish history as a place of a decisive battle. That's where King Josiah was killed by the Pharaoh, who was on his way to protect the people from coming over the Euphrates River. So you think that's all coincidental that we talk about Megiddo and Armageddon and the great river Euphrates? It's not meant to be something that we find meaning in today. This had meaning to the Jews. And it all had meaning to Jewish history. It all had meaning to the old prophets. And there were things that had already been said and had meaning to the audience when they heard it. So I don't think it's what most people think it is. I'm not worried about the 200 million men army. China may have a powerful army, and one of these days they may attack us. I don't know. But I don't believe that's because of a prophecy found in the book of Revelation. And I hope you don't have any questions, because I don't know why. But at least there's some insight onto the river Euphrates. So Jake, is the river Euphrates important? Yes. And it's been important to God's people since the Garden of Eden. But I believe Revelation uses it symbolically, and something that we shouldn't worry about when we see pictures of the river drying.